Marketers, are you ready to make an impact with audio advertising? People are hungry for authentic connections in a world buzzing all around us. How do you cut through the noise and truly reach your audience? Visit stateofaudio.com to see Odyssey State of Audio, the Trends Report. Uncover the secrets to high-impact creative. Learn how AI is revolutionizing the industry. And get ahead of the curve on measurement and audience trends. Don't just stay in the game. Win it. Visit stateofaudio.com and download your free copy.
Welcome to The Connection, a weekly radio program where we share our experiences and expertise with stories of caring, courage, and change right here in Connecticut. Listen to learn about needed resources to improve your well-being and transform your life. Now, here are the hosts of The Connection, Lisa DeMattis-Lepore and Ann Baldwin.
And we're back. Welcome again to The Connection. As you just heard in the introduction, I am Ann Baldwin. We've also got the Chief Executive Officer of The Connection, Lisa DeMattis-Lepore, here as well. And you're enjoying your summer so far?
Summer's going well.
It's going fast, isn't it?
It's going really fast. But I'm excited because we're finally getting sunshine and some warmer weather, so that's great.
Yeah.
So what that tells me is maybe September, October, summer may drag out. Who knows? But as long as it's not raining, it's all good.
It is. Well, you know what I got to say, too, because we had, you know, some bad bouts with weather, and really this is your background. I just felt like I was in a funk, and so was everybody else around me. Isn't it true that when the sun's not out and it's kind of dreary and rainy, people just aren't themselves?
I agree.
What do they call that? Seasonal depression?
Seasonal
affective disorder. Sad.
Sad.
Sad?
Yes.
And you're like, who's that man talking? Let's tell you who the man is.
The man.
The man is Charles Barber. And Charles, I know when you hear those little, you know, initials, you got to just jump in there. So we didn't get a chance to say an official hello, but we'll do that now. You are the director of the Connection Institute for Innovative Practice. And you've been on this program before and you're back just because you've got so much to talk about.
Thank you.
That's right. So, Lisa, talk a little bit about, from the Connections perspective, and what Charles does and how important, increasingly important, it's becoming to measure outcomes. Because with funding issues in the state, I mean, you know, you're a nonprofit. There's so many nonprofits out there that are struggling, and the dollars are getting harder and harder to come by. So how are you kind of combating that, or, you know, working against the tide at this point?
Well, I think that what we're doing, we're looking at really all the strengths that we have at The Connection. And one of those is really our data and research component. And Charlie really heads up that department. Charlie's brilliant. He's published. He's fun to be around also. Right, Charlie? Makes me laugh.
I'm fun.
Wait a minute.
He's
a
fun
research guy that's fun?
He is.
That's like, you know, saying
a great sense of humor.
An accountant who's fun. It's kind of the same
thing.
All right,
well, we're not going to talk about accountants, although I'm not going to go down that road. But that's stretching it. But I think that what's unique about our human service agency is that we do have a department that's dedicated to data and research. Most organizations are not. We have strong affiliations, thanks to Charlie, with Wesleyan University, and he also teaches there.
What do you teach?
I teach writing.
Writing?
And
yeah.
Criminal. I just taught some
grant
criminal
writing
justice.
Or?
No, I teach nonfiction writing because I'm a writer in addition.
That's right. You've got a couple books that we have to talk about, but we'll let Lisa get to her point first. I can't wait to talk about that.
And then I just finished a criminal justice courses called Race, Incarceration, and Citizenship at Wesleyan this year.
What was it called?
It was a series of courses called Race, Incarceration, and Citizenship on criminal justice issues, which are extremely popular with students now. You know, they, just from a public health and a public resource perspective, people really realize the rates of incarceration in the United States now.
What major does that fall into? What are the, most of the
all,
folks majoring all different, in? Or is it?
All different majors. It was cross-listed in multiple
it?
Departments. But at Wesleyan, they have something called the Alberton Center for the Study of Public Life. And Alberton had a lot of TV stations in New York, in D.C., and they sold them, and they created the magazine Politico. And so it's, and they're alums, and so they've put together all this public service and public issue awareness stuff at Wesleyan with real resources. And we, The Connection, partnered with them this whole year to teach classes.
Wow.
Yeah.
How interesting.
Yep.
That is fantastic. So a lot of the work that, you know, Charlie's also a grant writer, but in addition to that, Charlie is really tying back the data and the research to the programs that we run, and we're looking at recidivism rates, which are extremely low. And, you know, Charlie's very creative in thinking about better ways that we can, you know, bring forth the data that we have and use it to, you know, show to folks in the state of Connecticut. But also, I think it's a good checklist for us to say we're really doing a good job, and these are the elements that we're measuring to show that, you know, the clients in Connecticut, the citizens, are not, you know, going back into the system. And so, you know, I want Charlie to talk a little bit about some of the work that he's done today, but also I'm really proud of Charlie because he has written two amazing books. I'm going to have you talk about that. And he's an amazing writer. I think, you know, when Charlie, you know, would send me during his period of writing, you know, paragraphs or chapters of the book to read, I was just, when is, just get the next chapter done, because I was like sitting on the edge of my seat, because he's a writer that I think that once you read the first sentence of his book, you're there, because you can just visually feel that you're experiencing what he's writing about, which I, and I'm not just saying that because he's here. I don't think I've ever read a book so intensely than that. So, Charlie, without further ado, tell us a little bit about your two books and, you know, what led you to write those books.
Well, the first book is called Songs from the Black Chair, and we talked the last show, Anne, about the importance of lived experience and how the connection is dedicated increasingly to hiring our former clients who were doing well, carefully vetted, you know, had long lengths of sobriety and so on as staff people. And that, you know, we talked last time about how that we found in our federally funded research that it's led to more positive outcomes in terms of reduced crime and cost savings and so on. So the story behind that for me personally is I grew up in Middletown. I was a really good student. I went to Harvard, and then I had my own experience with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, when I was a young man. And I went from, I actually had symptoms when I was very young, 5 or 6 years old, but I just was able to manage, and, you know, I did well in high school and all that good stuff. And then I got to Harvard and I had a kind of a break with OCD. It sort of, it felt like a shopping bag that had too much stuff in it and all the jars fell out. Like it just, you know, it just sort of happened. And I didn't know, this was some time ago, there were things like, I didn't even know what OCD was, actually. I didn't come from, this is before Oprah, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, so, before it was popular.
Right, right. And so I just thought, my main reaction was like, don't tell anybody.
Right, right.
So I ended up getting some help and doing, I ended up actually dropping out, and I worked in a group home for developmentally disabled folks in Central Connecticut. And it was actually the perfect therapy for me because two reasons. One, it got me out of my own head, which I was heavily involved in my own head. And second, the place that I was actually placed at, the kids there were my age, and they were, so they're 20, and they were all severely developmentally disabled, and they could not speak, and they had many, many physiological issues. And so it made me realize, one, that my issues were significant for me, but they weren't their issues. And also for me, a lot of my symptomatology was around verbal things, and so being in a quiet environment was like, it was perfect self-therapy. So all this to say, I wrote a book about this at the same time as this was going on with me. My best friend in high school committed suicide from mental health and substance abuse issues. So, and really as a result of these experiences, instead of being a professor, which I am now through an indirect route, but which was kind of what I was supposed to do, I ended up working in homeless shelters in New York City for 10 years. And so the book is about my own, the story I just told, and then working in shelters and how I did and did not have things in common with the clients that I worked with. And so so the story behind the story of our research that we're doing is I learned before there was really research to show the importance of lived experience and having been there and done that. Although I never actually shared my own personal story with my clients, but when I was in supervision, clinical supervision with, this was in New York City with psychiatrists from Columbia and NYU and, you know, very, very rich academic resources and excellent clinical training that I got, but I could feel that I knew something from our client's perspective that the pure professionals did not know. Mm-hmm. Not that I had schizophrenia, and, you know, in some ways a lot of my own issues, which are completely resolved, are completely minor compared to, you know, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, homelessness, et cetera, et cetera. But I had, the way I put it in the book actually is that I'd walked a little bit in their forest.
You know, and I think that does add credibility. I know when I was in rehab and we had these counselors, or, you know, we had these people that were working with us, you know, I was so new to it. One of my first questions was, you know, have you been there? Have you been through this? Are you in recovery? And the minute somebody said no to me initially, I pulled back a little bit. I shut down a little bit because I felt like at that point mm-hmm. in my recovery, if you don't know what I'm going through, then you can't help me. Mm-hmm. So I absolutely get that. The name of the book again, and where can people find it?
It's called Songs from the Black Chair, and it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all that good stuff. It was the irony is, it, you know, when I was going through this, people were like, what's wrong with you, right? Because, then I wrote about it in the book, got, you know, won awards, got wonderful reviews. So my basic story is I became a success about writing about my failures. So,
Wow, I love that.
Yeah, it's a good way to go.
You know, I got to tell you, that's on my bucket list.
Yeah, right.
To write a book. And I keep being reminded I could be on my fifth book by now just because, you know, the things that happen. So, you know, good, but it's hard. It has to be hard, right? Is it not, Charles, to put your stuff out there? You know, when you really are putting your real demons out there for consumption, and here we are trying to, you know, be normal people, you know, run businesses, have lives, have relationships, and we wonder, is this going to help us or hurt us? What was the impact of writing the book and being so honest about it?
Yeah, it definitely requires intestinal fortitude to do, and then other people are involved too, because you're writing, even if they're, you know, obliquely referenced, you're writing about other people, so it's not just you. But in general, the book was extremely well received, and I'll give you a very specific example. I've done work with the Department of Correction through the Connection as a trainer and a consultant, and the book came out, and I had a supervisor at the Department of Correction that I was a little worried about him knowing about all this because I worked with him for years, and he read the book. He called me up. He said, I have more respect for you than I did before, you know, and I had a lot of respect for you before is what he was saying. So in general, Lisa, my boss, I think partially we've come to a place societally that people yeah. understand that this is not a characterological deficit. This is in many, many ways physiological illnesses, and so, you know, the irony is that it did tremendous things for my career, but I was careful in how I presented it to people. The way that it first went public was an article that I wrote in the New York Times, and so that, you know, I got contacted from people from 20 years ago. But I have to say 95% of the response was positive. And the people that aren't positive, you
Who
know.
Who needs them?
Right.
So I want to share a quick story. Mm-hmm. So when the book came out, you know, Charlie had shared some of the chapters from that book with me prior to it, you know, getting published. And so I read the book and, you know, I was picturing everything in my head and, you know, he talked about Wesleyan and, you know, being in Middletown and, you know, talked about where his best friend that committed suicide was buried. And I knew exactly the cemetery that he was talking about in Middletown. And I asked him if we could meet at a Dunkin' Donuts and then walk across the street. Would he take me to the cemetery to go sit by the grave of his friend? And he did. And it just brought me to tears because I felt that I actually knew this you know, this gentleman that he was friends with, and you know, it was, for me, it was really it was an intense moment, and you know, it was very private for Charlie and personal, but he did take me there, and you know, I was very moved. So I think the book is great, and I hope that folks will, you know, read it and learn more about this brilliant man that I have on staff here at the Connection. Really proud of him, and you know, grateful to be his colleague and friend, and you know, we have a lot of work to do, Charlie, moving forward, and we're doing that. But I encourage you, Anne, to actually, I should have brought a copy of the book today.
Yeah.
Charlie did a really wonderful thing. My elderly mother's, you know, going through a tough time right now because my dad died right before Christmas, and Charlie had both of his books sent to my house for my mom to read, and she can't put the book down. So I wanted to say thank you for that. And she was, you know, saying, "Oh, I can't believe that you have, you know, this type of talent and, you know, compassionate man on your staff that, you know, really does this work, and his reading is so beautiful." So, you know, thank you for that, Charlie. So,
you know, and Charlie, you mentioned you don't know what people's reaction is going to be, whether we've had breast cancer or addiction issues or whatever it might be. And in my early recovery, you know, I got back from rehab and I was sober 2 months and I was ready to tell everybody, "Hey, I'm in recovery," you know, and it was a peer. It was a person who is in recovery, long-term recovery themselves, who said, "Hold on a minute. Step back. Give it some time," because you don't know what people's reaction would be.
Mm-hmm.
You know what was interesting for me as a business owner is that none of my clients knew that I even had an issue,
mm-hmm.
or that I spent, 4 weeks in a rehab, because my staff was so supportive. But when I did come out and tell people, I got nothing but support.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And if people said things that weren't appropriate, I don't know about it. And my business has actually increased because I work with a lot of people in the industry and that are in recovery themselves who are successful business owners and people just like us. So, you know, oftentimes, isn't it, like you said, it was a career changer for you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's worth the risk, isn't it, to kind of tell people that, you know, this is what I've gone through and here's how I deal with it, so that we can help other people. If we don't put a face and a voice on it, what good is it?
Right. And one of the things that shocked me with the you know, feedback from people was how much they related to the book. So when I was going through it, and you know, when you go through problems, especially as a younger person, you have this feeling of like, no one in the world has ever gone through this before, and that's the way I felt, you know, especially because I didn't even know what it was. I really didn't know what it was.
What do you mean?
I didn't know what OCD was, so I didn't know when I was having these symptoms. I didn't know. I thought there was,
because
just,
back then it wasn't.
It existed in the American Psychiatric Diagnostic Manual, but it was not in the culture.
Right.
It was, you know, this, and so and then, you know, the book is very specific about Middletown, about Wesleyan, about, you know, mm-hmm. my story. So and any good writer knows that the it comes alive through the details. So if I wrote about very, very specific details. It was a Budweiser we were drinking, not a Heineken, you know. Mm-hmm. And
that's what they call brand placement.
Right. Yes. I'll expect a check later. But the almost universal thing was how much people related. Not that they necessarily had OCD, but I think that it's a coming of age story. It's some of the issues like substance abuse, which was not my issue, but that's absolutely universal. And I wrote about that about my friend, suicide, where, you know, so many of us have known people who commit suicide. Mm-hmm. And so so many people said that it was helpful to them.
Good.
I found the book helpful for myself because I gained a greater appreciation not only for the work that we do, but also to have a colleague who was able to really, you know, put his story out there for people to understand and read. And many of our staff read the book, and you know, it just sort of brings you closer to the fact that, again, and we've talked about this in the other programs that we've, you know, done together, that this affects all of us. You know, all these types of issues and the clients that we see and the folks around us are all, like we said, Ann, everyone is carrying some type of, there's some struggle, right? And I think we always need to be mindful of that. I think it's really quick to judge and not understand, you know, that, you know, be kind to people because they're all, you know, carrying some type of a burden or their own fight of their own. And So I think that having that passion and working in this field is key, and you can never really lose that.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Charles Barber. He's a director of the Connection Institute for Innovative Practice. And, of course, we've got our chief executive officer, Lisa DeMattis-Lepore, here as well. So, Charles, you didn't just stop at one, right? I guess like a good author, it's like here comes chapter two. So what's your second book about, and are you going to keep going in that direction? But I'll let you answer the first question.
Yeah. So I wrote a second book called Comfortably Numb. And what happened is, as a result of these personal experiences, I ended up almost, you know, it wasn't the plan, working in homeless shelters with people diagnosed with severe mental illness in New York in the 90s.
But there was a reason.
There was a reason. Right. It wasn't what I, you know, life happens to you when you're busy making other plans, sort of thing. So, and so this was basically the 90s. And the book is about the impact of psychiatric medications on American culture. And it begins with an anecdote where in 1990, I was at a cocktail party with friends of my parents, and I was talking about my job, and they were sort of like, what's wrong with these people that you're working with in these homeless shelters? And do they must take a lot of crack and that kind of stuff. And then 10 years later, I didn't go to too many cocktail parties with my parents, but I went to one other and about 10 years later. And everybody thought what I was doing was great. And they were asking me, well, what about lithium versus Prozac? And they were basically, you know, either they or their children, or they knew somebody who were on all the medications that my clients were on. And so that the question of the book is, how did it change so quickly? How did we go from a characterological based understanding of mental illness to in some ways, very overly simplistic, biological-based understanding of mental illness. Basically, you know, these terms like chemical imbalance started coming out. They're really based on a sort of dumbed-down version of the science. So, it's really a sociological book. So, for instance, I wrote a lot about the TV advertising, which just popped up, which made them consumer products, made these drugs consumer products like toothpaste. And you see it now, it's probably part of the opioid stuff going on. There's been a whole generation that's grown up with, we're all roughly the same age. I know that we thought of prescription drugs as, that's a big deal.
That's why they were in a locked medicine cabinet. Like you never opened the medicine cabinet.
Right.
Not today.
Right. So kids born since 1987, which is when these ads started, and it was a simple rule change by the FCC, they subliminally think of these things as like toothpaste or Ford cars. So the book is partially about the kind of what happened at various levels in our attitudes. And then the second part of it is actually very much relates to the connections work. And my work is, the drugs can be fantastic, and that's not part of the argument of the book. The drugs can be fantastic, but they got kind of oversold. And what also got lost in that was some really good work about engaging clients, cognitive behavioral therapy, the peer work that we've talked about, the technique called motivational interviewing, where you work with people to enhance their own sense of motivation rather than imposing it. Nobody paid attention to that stuff. And if you look at the research, the efficacy of those treatments can be as good or better than the drugs. So it's sort of the thing that we missed by paying all the attention to the Zoloft ads.
So what section, you said these books, and again, just give us both titles of the books, and they're available on Amazon and they're at Barnes & Noble. So what section do you go to?
The memoir would be in the autobiography section.
Okay, give us the name of the memoir.
It's Songs from the Black Chair.
All right.
And a memoir of mental interiors is, and then the medication book would be in the psychology section, and it's called Comfortably Numb, referencing Pink Floyd, and it's called How Psychiatry is Medicating a Nation.
You know, and it's interesting, Lisa, it's great. I want to get my hands on those books, and I appreciate the offer, but I, you know, an author can't thrive and survive if you don't go buy their book, right? So
that's
I'm going
right.
to go buy their book. But, it, you know, you brought up a really good point of how it's just kind of been neutralized, right? The drugs. You know, I as somebody who's worked in television and now works in marketing, you know, it's a 60-second spot. With all the side effects and people fishing and, you know, holding birthday parties, at least they've gotten smarter about running the disclaimer with some interesting video coverage because it kind of tells a story. But I think the internet has also changed thing. And what I would hope has changed is the transparency, that people aren't as afraid to share their weaknesses and their issues and get the help that they so desperately need in so many cases. And that's where the connection comes into play. So that's fantastic. It really is. And we want to mention, too, you can go to theconnectioninc.org, all one word, theconnectioninc.org. You know, just educate yourselves, right? Everybody's got an opinion. Everybody's got a background. But, you know, you need to do kind of your own research, don't you? If you don't have on-the-job experience like we do, mm-hmm. you and I.
Absolutely.
That's what I say. I've got, you know, real-life on-the-job experience. Not proud of that, but I'm grateful for it because it helps me help others, too. And that's what you guys, that you all have, too. And the peer-to-peer support, we all know it works.
Mm-hmm.
It works. You can
mm-hmm.
study it. And people can't argue about, you know, research and numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you fight that? It is what it is.
Mm-hmm. So the connection is working very closely with a group at Yale in the psychiatry department that's created a research-proven citizenship intervention for very formerly marginalized people, where it's less about it is about their clinical services, but it's also teaching the skills of citizenship. And he defines them as the roles, responsibilities, resources, relationships, and rights of citizenship. And what that really comes down to is a sense of belonging and feeling supported. And again, we're starting to incorporate this intervention at the Connection with Yale. But the story behind the story for me, again, is my own recovery had a lot to do with clinical treatment, but it also had to do with finding meaning. And so the book, when you ask, you know, was it well received and how was it received? It was certainly well received. But I guess the most important thing was well received by me, right? Because it was part of me finding meaning and finding my own roles, relationships, resources, rights, etc., as someone who had been through things. So that's sort of, I think, where we're at is I'm using my own experiences to inform the research that we're doing at The Connection.
And what a great way and positive note to end this program. It's really been interesting. And, you know, thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope, Charles Barber. And Lisa, it's always great to see you. Another interesting conversation. And hopefully some useful information out there to our listeners. You know, it's one of those things I always say during this program. You might not need it today, but who knows what tomorrow brings, right?
Absolutely.
So thank you all for listening to this edition of The Connection right here on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once, once in a lullaby.